Very much, Maureen. So quite a familiar parable to many of us. Always good to be reminded of it. You may have noted, those of you who have been in church a while, will noted that I cut off the end bit, which is about the older son. So we're going to look at that in the sermon, but it just seems a really flat way to end a parable, is looking at the older son. So I think the mood of celebration, I think, should continue from us reading that parable. So this is probably, many consider this the greatest of Jesus' parables, definitely I think the most significant of all of them, and we'll explore why it's significant. Often it's used in modern parlance in secular society. It's really interesting how even in a generation that have pretty much kind of ignored the call of God, there's still lots of things that are biblical that people just come out with without having a clue where they come from. So in this chapter, there are three parables recorded by Luke that Jesus said. The lost sheep, you know, the 99 that came home, the farmer that goes out, the shepherd that goes out to look for the last sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son. This is what we're looking at today. So why did Jesus, first of all, repeat his message three times? Well, here we have the answer. Maybe one sheep out of 100, maybe we consider it shrinkage in modern language. We may feel sentimental as modern people towards that lost sheep, but the Jews of the first century would definitely not have. Just one of those things, you've lost a sheep, get on with life. The lost coin, a more significant material loss, but because it was lost in the house, eventually it would have been found. But the parable of the lost son is about human relationships, family. Interesting that this is just not an issue just for our time. Who hasn't got issues within their families? I hear about those constantly. Jesus introduces us to three people, a father and his two sons. Jesus, that master storyteller, what a beautiful piece of art that Maureen has read. He sketches out beautifully the context of this young man's request. This is the stuff of parental nightmares for the first century Jew. The renegade, self-destructive son. The obscenity of asking for part of your estate before your father has even died. Jewish law stated that the older son would get about two-thirds of the estate, the younger son would get one-third. But it was the father who obviously got to choose if he wanted to distribute his estate before he died. Proverbs 20 says, "An inheritance claimed too soon will not be blessed at the end." So, curses on early distributions of estate. But the younger son acts in a way far more horrendous than perhaps we at first recognize. He's really, in effect, saying to his father, "I wish you were dead." The father would have been within his rights in Jewish law to have had his son then put to death. The words the prodigal, the lost son, uses demonstrates an overwhelming selfishness. Imagine as a parent what you would feel about this sense of entitlement from your child. What he was demanding would have caused major upheaval to his father's farming business. So the father, as we hear, managed to get the money together. The son is off to a far country to party, to gamble, and to obey the dictum, "Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." Incredibly, who would have thought it, the money runs out. And all the friends who he had bought drinks for just fade away into the background. This stupid, selfish young man began to recognize that he might need to find some work, some income at last. And being a farmer's son, you'd have expected him to have lots of practical skills, but he seems to have learnt nothing on the farm and can only do what no other Jew would do, feed the pigs. The lost son is in a bad way. He's seen life, he's enjoyed the bright lights, and now most clearly he is struggling. This is a very special time for him. So I'm not saying that our goal in life should be pig farmers, but this menial job gives him time alone, just with the pigs, away from the noise, away from illusory friends, a chance to think. And he uses that time to look at his situation with clarity. What has it come to? What are my prospects now? Remember, he had pragmatism. He had a pragmatic look at his life. And Jesus encourages that. There's a couple of parables where he talks about a building project in one parable, and he says, be careful that you don't run out of money halfway through. You want to build a tower, make sure that you have the money to build that tower. Think about it, work your sums out first. And he said, anybody who wants to follow me must think about it seriously, the pros and the cons, before they go ahead and follow me. I think it's important that we recognise and remind ourselves regularly that God ensures that there is no waste in our lives. And these periods, some of us, we have periods of sickness, we have periods when we are jobless, we have periods when we're caring for a chronically ill loved one. They're perhaps the most important, because a gap suddenly opens up in our schedule. No longer can we rush around doing all the stuff that we feel is so essential in our life. We have time to stop and think. So somebody was asking, I think Tuesday House Group were asking me when I became a Christian, because I grew up in a Christian family, but my behaviour as a child when I was at primary school in London was not good. In fact, it was kind of very bad. And then I still went to school, but I behaved very differently at school. Still went to church, but I behaved very differently at school than I did at church. And then suddenly you get that period, don't you, where the summer of your 11th birthday, when you're moving from primary to secondary, and I was moving to a grammar school, and there was maybe two in my class that were moving up to the grammar school. So there was a period of like, what's going to happen next? And that period over the summer was the period when I heard the kind of the voice of God. And there was a lovely preacher who used to preach very solid gospel messages. And that was my window. That was the time when the gap between primary school and secondary school was the time when I kind of said yes to God. So we see, again, back to the prodigal son, we see his sense of entitlement. Why can't I become a servant in my father's house? Well, we might think, surely you've burned your bridges there. What have you done to your father? What have you done to his business? But the prodigal is desperate. He's not completely sorted. He doesn't seem completely repentant. He still seems quite overpleased with himself. But he decides he's going to go back to see his father. So he treks for many days. He's in a bad way. And we note here that the father has not gone searching for him. He allows the son to go. He has given him freedom to make good or bad choices. But the bad choices he made has brought him to this dire situation. Inevitably, really, when you look at it, inevitably that he ended up in this way. His father didn't make this happen to punish him. It's the son's free will. He could have used the money any which way that he chose. He didn't try to force him home, but he waits for him. So just as the farm is beginning to come into the view for the prodigal son, his breath is taken from him by his father's embrace. So you think, day after day, week after week, month after month, the father went out around the borders of his farm and looked for that figure. Maybe at times he would have despaired that he would ever see him again, but yet he continued to do the walk around the farm. So the prodigal son manages to say those first few words of a very carefully prepared statement that must have gone round and round in his head, but his father ignores his words, brings his best robe, shoes, and a ring. Now, the significance of these is that the father has shown that he has fully restored him to his place in the family. Not that just he has raised his standings by bringing him shoes, quite a lot about shoes in the Old Testament. If you want to read the Book of Ruth, that has stuff about shoes there. They're quite a symbol of respect to have shoes, but also there was a sign that the father had legally transferred the responsibility of using his property in the best way. He gave the younger son his signet ring. And that meant in the days when servants would run the business, the master would seal the contract, the deal, with a signet ring to show, yeah, this isn't just come from a servant, this has come from the master of the house. So in other words, he had immediately given the son full access to all the family money. That third that the son had run off with, the father is now saying, yeah, do what you like with the rest of them. I trust you. And then the father brings out the prize calf to be slaughtered, a bit like us having some maybe vintage champagne in the cupboard, right, waiting for a celebration. This man's son, who he'd assumed was lost, had been found, was dead, and now is alive. So that's all that mattered. No talk of time of probation. Yeah, we'll see how things go. Perhaps a couple of years as a servant to see if you could be trusted now. No, this was his son. So the party is started, the neighbours invited. And where is the older son? Well, he's working. He's the good, faithful son, still at home, dealing with a sorrowful father. And he hears the news and rushes to his father. Look at the words that the older son says. Jesus puts these words into his mouth. This son of yours, nothing to do with me, it's your son. And a reminder of the prodigal's supposed crime. The father is taken aback. This is your brother. Why don't you welcome him into the family? So now we're just going to briefly look at the context of this amazing parable, which continues to blow my mind, and to see what it can tell us. So there are two sets of listeners to Jesus' parables, the tax collectors and sinners, which is really all of us here, I would say, and the Jewish religious leaders, so people who thought, yep, we're in charge of the law, we can do what we like because we're fully obedient to God. And Jesus appeals directly to those religious leaders through the response of the older son. Many of these people were good people. They were conscientious. They would spend hours each day studying the law, the Torah, and they were genuine in their search for God. However, when somebody with the authority of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, came and spoke of God's gracious embrace being big enough for all of them, they couldn't cope. How is that person going into the kingdom of heaven? And look at me, I've done so much good. And I just get to go in with that person. I get to celebrate. They weren't big-hearted in their joy at this unexpected turn of events. But when we see the Old Testament, these people read the Old Testament day after day after day. They'd memorized probably all of the Old Testament. Read, if you get a chance, read the prophetic writings of Hosea. They chose these people to bring an end to the bringer of this good news. Their declaration was that there'll be joy in heaven over one sinner who is obliterated before God. Jesus, we read, turns that on its head. There'll be joy in heaven at one sinner who is welcomed into God's kingdom. So we get this sense of Jesus' challenge, his deep desire that they would embrace his message. So I've known some churchgoers who are a bit like these Pharisees and Jewish leaders. I don't think there's anybody here like that, but I've met them in other places. And it's always amazed me that these apparently really nice people become really narrow-minded and sour when it comes to talk about God. They know what they know. They can't have a discussion, we can't have a discussion about it. But the overwhelming message in Jesus' parable here is the outrageous, almost the obscene grace of God. Those Jewish listeners would have been repelled at what Jesus told them in that parable. Jesus tells this parable here and later demonstrates it with what he says on the cross. So Jesus was all about action and words together, consistency, total consistency. Remember on the cross, two thieves are crucified next to Jesus, one on the right, one on the left. One of them has a right go at Jesus, even when he's dying in agony, and the other one says, remember me. And Jesus turns to him and says, today you will be with me in paradise. So God's sense of fairness is very different than our sense of fairness. It's a kind of super fairness. He reaches out to embrace the vilest of people, the paedophile, the fraudster, even bankers. No one is beyond his grace. Jesus came to bring the message that the door of heaven is wide open. There's no qualifying exam. Just as this was a revelation for the tax collectors and sinners, so it will be for our community. So many have been put off church and God by those who go to church. At the very centre of God is love, and this is what motivates him. He created, he sustains, he blesses out of love for all his creatures. And he reaches out to you. He calls for you to return. You have been gone too long. He is not condemning you. He doesn't punish you. But call to him and there'll be great joy in heaven amongst the angels. I love the fact that when anybody turns to God and is received into his kingdom, that the angels have a party. Isn't that a beautiful sense of God's love for us? Amen.